This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy from Armature, providing software solutions for conformity assessment, standards, and policy management. Federal Tech Talk is the show that opens up the world of technology to the federal government. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts to help you understand some of the IT trends and challenges that your agency may be facing. Federal Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Christopher Fountain. He is a Senior Vice President of Secure Info, a Kratos, K-R-A-T-O-S, a Kratos company. Good morning, Christopher. How are you?
I'm doing well, John. Good morning.
We know this security topic we're going to talk about today can be sliced and diced in so many different ways. We can come in and do a two-hour show on mobile security. We can do a whole show on cloud security. I wanted to bring someone like you in the studio to bring your little perspective. You work with a lot of folks in the military and some of the intelligence community, and you have this interesting perspective because you've testified on Capitol Hill, and you've been down in the trenches, and you have a pretty good idea of what's going on in the whole world of security. And I thought we'd do a little bit of a deep dive on security and hit some of the big major points and maybe talk about Secure Info and how they can be of value to our listeners. But before we start, many of our listeners are scratching their heads going, Christopher Fountain, now, what's his background? How did he ever wind up at Secure Info? Maybe you can share with us some of your background, please.
Sure. Very good question. I've been in technology my whole career, more years than I care to count these days. Joined Secure Info in early 2006. So I've been with the company almost 6.5 years. Prior to that, worked in a variety of enterprise software solution provider companies. I worked in London for a company that provided solutions for the utility sector. And it all culminated with an opportunity to work in the security business. Having worked around enterprise software, supply chain software for many years, I certainly appreciate the impact systems can have on organizational effectiveness or the converse of that. And it was a great opportunity to play a key role in a key area. And now that I've been doing it for 6 years, I feel like I certainly, there's no such thing as being a master of this domain, but I feel like I certainly understand it.
Maybe know some of the questions after six
right,
years.
Exactly.
And you recently acquired by Kratos, is that right?
Correct. Kratos acquired Secure Info in November of last year.
And what's the value there? Is this 2 + 2 = 5 or?
It is that kind of value. Kratos is a company focused on national security solutions. Does a lot across the Department of Defense and also does a lot in critical infrastructure across the United States. Kratos has a division, for example, that's focused on providing physical security solutions to the World Trade Center and to the New York Port Authority and the major airports around New York City. Cybersecurity is certainly a complement to physical security. People understand the physical domain. I'm sure your listeners can relate to a theft at their home or money being stolen out of their wallet. Now you got to try to say, how does that translate into the cyber domain, which it certainly does. And then the other parts of Kratos serve the Department of Defense and other federal agencies. They didn't have a core focus in cybersecurity, but realized that cybersecurity is a matter of national security and a very good complement to other areas that Kratos served. So they acquired us, and we are now a unit inside Kratos. We maintained our identity, which is very important based on the kind of skill set you need for this type of business. And we're able to leverage the broader resources of a $1 billion company.
You know, this signal goes out to 50,000 watts, all kinds of people in gas stations are listening, people in the Pentagon are listening, many of my federal listeners are listening for a security topic here. And so when I talk about risk management and risk assessment, I think, well, geez, I left my digital camera in the car, someone broke the window and stole it. Okay, I get it, okay? Well, if I leave my social security number website and someone copies it, well, you know, I think that risk is more subtle and it's not obvious. And I just couldn't go to my 6-year-old neighbor and say, well, hey, James, someone stole my camera. You know, he wouldn't understand. So risk management, risk assessment, a little more difficult with cyber affairs, isn't it?
Absolutely. Much more different. And I actually think that the general population needs to learn a lot more about this in order to understand the implication of certain behavior.
A typical federal IT person listening to this show, I think, has a pretty good grasp on security. However, they're in a rapidly changing environment. People are going mobile, people are going to the cloud, and their budget's being restricted. And I think that's the challenge for many of my listeners now. We can talk about that financial challenge in a little bit. Let's back this up, look at more some policy implications of all this. Give us some a snapshot of the last 5, 10, 15 years in security and Capitol Hill and some of the bigger projects like FISMA and where they all fit in.
Sure. Kind of the DOD was working in this domain for many years before it caught the attention of the rest of government. And I say DOD, which includes the intelligence community. And they did some groundbreaking work and obviously led the way. In 2002, Congressman Davis led the effort to put a law in place that required federal agencies to secure their information assets. And that law was known as FISMA, the Federal Information Security Management Act. It was Title III of eGov. Authorized and became law in 2002. And it basically provided the foundation for this issue to get a lot of attention across the entire government, civilian agencies, as well as, of course, DOD and Intel.
So we see 9/11 and the reaction or the response is 2002. And FISMA really is a codification of a plan that includes best practices, clear metrics, and better collaboration between organizations.
That is correct. And it also sets up certain authorities and responsibilities in organizations like the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Dr. Ron Ross at NIST leads the FISMA project for NIST and is engaged in basically the production of the guidance, the recipe, if you will, for how to secure systems of all types and sizes and complexities.
So here it is 10 years later. And a lot of their policies have to change. I mean, in 10 years, all kinds of things are changing. And so they have a new publication coming out and kind of a revision of the initial policies. Is that right?
That's correct. Actually, one of the beauties of the work that NIST does is it lives. The law was instituted in 2002. Since that time, the special publication series, it's called the 800 series, has been updated many, many times, much more frequently than other standards bodies update their information security guidance, which is one of the hallmarks of NIST, is they're very active in this process and very collaborative. And as you mentioned, 853 revision 4 is due out this summer within the next month or two. And obviously it's the fourth revision of a major kind of anchor publication within that series.
You know, when I hear of a standard, I keep thinking of, you know, you go to Disney World and here's a standard. You got to be 4 foot tall to ride this. Okay, that's pretty simple. But some of these standards are 350 page books for one standard alone. I mean, this is a very complex endeavor.
Yeah, absolutely. And 853 is one publication in a series of many. Some people think, well, why don't we make this simpler and look at all this documentation? Well, the fact is it's a very complex issue and there's no easy button. It's just like moving an army into a warfighting theater. Lots of things have to be considered. Lots of care has to be given and you need to be highly diligent. And that really is what the publications are all about, is making sure that you dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and you're very thorough. I should mention, NIST doesn't have the standards. Standards are actually dictated by OMB and others. NIST provides the guidance, which others may say have to become the standard. But if you talk to Dr. Ross, he talks about that we're providing a framework. They don't understand the mission impact of certain controls or implementation of the guidance. So the agency officials maintain the authority to decide, is this guidance I should adopt or not? And that's an important kind of thought process that NIST goes through, is they're providing guidance so that others can make the right decision and make an informed decision.
So if we tried to write a history of the past 10 years, could we say that in a nutshell, the transition in FISMA is to continuous monitoring? Is it that simple?
It's more complex than that, I think. FISMA has not been amended. When I testified a few years ago, it was testifying about revisions to FISMA. It was at that time known as FISMA 2.0. The beauty of it, though, is even without new legislation, NIST has evolved the guidelines in such a way that they're able to put more emphasis on things like continuous monitoring. The current, the kind of historically, you've had to look at systems every 3 years in a very rigorous way, and go through what was called a certification and accreditation. It became known as a security authorization process under the new latest guidance. And every 3 years you would do that deep dive and then reaccredit or officially authorize that system. Well, continuous monitoring is about basically looking at things on a continuing basis on a frequency that makes sense so that you're managing risk on a more active basis over day in and day out, week in and week out, month in and month out, and not going through a 3 year cycle. Because clearly systems change in a very rapid fashion. Looking at something every 3 years is not sufficient. So continuous monitoring got more emphasis, based on NIST's work without any new legislation.
And what your company does is you help listeners who work for the federal government understand these in detail. So you offer classes and training on how to comply with many of these standards. Is that right?
That is correct, yep.
So it's, you know, dealing with security companies, you always have to be very careful about who your clients are and what you do. We can talk in generalities here, is that you folks have a very good reputation for in-depth knowledge of many of these standards and how to comply with it. So if you're a federal IT professional listening and you get promoted and all of a sudden you got to make sure a transition to the cloud is secure, well, how can you know that if you're trained well enough to understand what compliance is all about and they can avail themselves of your services? Is that right?
That is correct. We would be honored to serve them.
So these all face-to-face classes, these online, or how do you do these classes?
The classes that we offer are primarily face-to-face classes. They're led by an instructor who's actually been a practitioner that understands how to do this work on the ground.
Good to know.
We offer them on-site and in our classrooms.
Let's take a little break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about some details, talk about maybe this exploit called Flame, and a little bit more about cybersecurity. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President, Secure Info, a Kratos company. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President, Secure Info, a Kratos company. We're talking about security from maybe a little higher level, maybe 40,000 feet, talking about a lot of the big issues, talking about compliance, talking about NIST. You know, if you read all the publications that deal with the federal government, you'll find out some agencies, of course, are getting pushed to the cloud. Some are resistant because they're resisting because of security concerns. I mean, I heard a quote from an agency where the CIO said, you know, there's been an exponential increase in cyber attacks in recent years, and they're just not ready to move to the cloud. Wow. I mean, that's shocking when a CIO of a big agency says that, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing that is slowing the adoption of cloud is the concern about information security.
What has been done legislatively in this area? We talked about FISMA in the first block. There are things going on in Capitol Hill. I think Lieberman Collins has some kind of a policy thing going on. Do you are you familiar with what's going on out there?
I am familiar, not with every single bill, because there are dozens of bills on the Hill right now that in some way touch cybersecurity. The one bill that I am very familiar with is the Cybersecurity Act of 2012. That is a Lieberman Collins bill.
That's the one.
Rockefeller and Feinstein, I think, were also part of that bill. And that one has gotten the most attention. It's frankly a pretty sweeping piece of legislation. Not sure it'll get enacted this year, given the it's an election year. But that legislation's got what I consider to be some very, very positive elements and some things that I don't know if we're ready for them yet.
Any details?
Sure. Everybody understands the backdrop we live in here, which is that we're under attack. There are real threats, and those threats, our national security is not at threat just because the federal government is under attack, but also because potentially the critical infrastructure is under attack. And people talk about their computer not working, but when the lights go out, bigger problems start to occur. So this legislation works to get at protection of the critical infrastructure, which most of it, 90% of that infrastructure is owned by the private sector. And some of the elements that I consider to be very positive elements are providing more formality for information sharing between government and industry and academia, for that matter. That already happens to some extent, but this bill provides a broader framework for that and would I think lead to more collaboration. The other thing that it provides is some protection from litigation, some liability protection to corporations that do the right things, which I think is also a good thing. Another key element that's very positive is a public awareness campaign. You know, the people talk about, and I'm a big believer, that we need a Smokey the Bear for cyber. Everybody understood the risk of forest fires, and Smokey the Bear was the icon for that. I think we need a similar kind of public service announcement for cybersecurity, because everybody can play a part by doing the right things at home on their personal computing equipment. Some of the things I think that are probably going too far in the legislation, it sets up a regulatory framework where critical infrastructure organizations could be held liable to be fined by the federal government if they're found to be non-compliant. And I think the issue, John, is that we're not in a place today where it's a black and white world. No one really knows exactly what should be done for every mission set to provide the proper protections to their information assets. And to set up a regulatory framework where the government's going to be looking over industry's shoulder and then going to be fined for doing for not doing this or that or for doing the wrong things will create a wall between government and industry, which I don't think will be good for collaboration. I think we're at a point now where industry, government, and academia need to work together. I think we all realize we're in a very tough place right now. We're heavily dependent on this infrastructure, this internet, and all the computing devices around it. And we need to protect it. And we need to work together to figure out the best methods and best practices for doing so. And today we all live in a glass house, so I don't think anybody should stand on the front porch and throw rocks.
You know, during the introductory remarks from this program, you didn't mention much background. You have a degree in engineering, don't you?
Correct.
And you mentioned you work with utilities. So kind of interesting that, you know, you kind of change careers and move into information assurance and comes back to utilities, doesn't it? I mean, you have a good perspective on security for utilities as well, don't you?
Yeah, and if you think about utilities, they're heavily dependent on what are called SCADA systems, supervisory control and data acquisition systems that control basically the production of power, turning open valves, closed valves, and so on. Those systems are typically air-gapped, but there are ways to cross that air gap, as we know from the Stuxnet virus that impacted Iran. And cybersecurity has got to be dealt with at that level as well as in the highly networked world. The other thing that's happening in the utility sector is the smart grid. Everybody talks about the smart grid and trying to do a better job of balancing supply and demand and more dynamic pricing for energy consumption. Well, that becomes more networked in that case, again, making security a bigger challenge.
I'm just thinking about the legislation and finding people for not being compliant. I mean, how can you be compliant for a zero-day attack if it's new and unexpected? I mean,
yeah, they basically are going to be leaning on guidance like what NIST publishes to say, have you done the proper diligence and care? The bottom line is, I think it's a fact that everybody will be compromised at some point in time. The big issue is, are you well positioned to respond and mitigate a compromise in a very timely fashion? I mean, there are talks today about companies that have been compromised that they don't even know it for a month or more. There were articles in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago about Nortel Networks and how the people were inside Nortel Networks for years, exfiltrating intellectual property out of Nortel, and it was one of the potential reasons that Nortel lost its competitive edge.
And Siemens was the target for the attack with the Stuxnet, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's a Siemens control system inside the Iranian centrifuge, where the centrifuges are deployed in Iran.
What's interesting is these are phone systems, and you don't usually think of viruses on phone systems, just like utilities. You don't think of malicious attack on utilities. But that was the fascinating part about the Stuxnet, is that it was a Siemens system. And why I was fascinated about Flame was that it was air-gapped, and they still managed to get in. So some of the obvious defenses just don't seem to work anymore.
That's true. And I always say that the greatest vulnerability is the user. We as users are trusting, I think, generally speaking. And in that particular case, the story goes that there was a USB drive, a thumb drive, that had been planted somehow in the physical infrastructure of the...
No, by the way, I found one in the parking lot this morning. Why don't you plug it into your notebook computer?
Don't put it in your computer. That's not a good idea. But, you know, users, they see a blank CD. They wonder what's on that CD. They pop it on the CD drive and boom, they get infected. They plug in a USB drive and boom, they're infected. And they don't even know it. The other thing users are notorious for is clicking on links. They get an email, click on a link, and bam, they've been exploited. Today, these social networks that are available provide the general public a way to understand more about somebody that they don't know than they would otherwise be able to figure out. So they, for example, know that I'm linked to John Gilroy and I'm linked to, you know, Bob and Sally. And if I get an email from John Gilroy that they spoof, I will be generally more trusting of that email, click on the link, and boom, I've been hit. So you've got to be very vigilant. And that's where, again, I think a public awareness campaign would be helpful.
And I think just the transition to mobile devices, when you're sitting at your desk and you're having a cup of coffee and everything's great, the temperature's perfect, something comes in, you're not going to fall for it. But if you're in your car or waiting to pick up your kids at a hockey match and you see something on your phone and you're going to hit it probably more often than you would at a desk. So you're more vulnerable just having mobile devices.
Absolutely. You're basically expanding the boundaries of the net. I got a text message not too long ago that was promoting that I'd won some kind of contest at Best Buy and it had an embedded link. And I sent it to my security experts and I said, you know, Mike, check this attack vector out because we're being attacked from many different angles. And it's just another platform to exploit.
Advanced Persistent Threat, APT. Maybe give us a quick 30 seconds on what APT is, and we'll extend that discussion after the break.
Sure. Well, it is exactly that. It's advanced, and it's persistent. It's highly sophisticated attack vectors that where an adversary that's well organized, that's well funded, is intent on compromising a target. And it
so Flame is an APT.
Flame is APT. Yep, it's a platform for doing cyber espionage. Stuxnet is related to Flame in some way. It appears now that Flame was out in the on the internet before Stuxnet. It rode behind Flame, and those would be categorized as advanced persistent threats.
So the email that says a Nigerian millionaire wants to give you some money in London, that goes out to millions of people. The APTs, they don't care about a million targets. They may have 50 targets, or may just have 5 targets they're going to go after,
or one,
and they'll go after it every single day until they compromise it.
Right. If you look at what happened to EMC, to the RSA division of EMC, that was clearly an advanced persistent threat attack where they spent lots of time. They're very patient. And they found a way in to compromise the secure token.
It had kind of a ripple effect throughout the industry for many years, if I recall. Let's take a quick break and come back, talk more about InfoSec and maybe mobile computers and maybe touch on FedRAMP. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are speaking with Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President Secure Info at Kratos Company. Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President, Secure Info, a Kratos company. For more information, you can go to secureinfocorp.com. I think that's the URL. Is that right, Christopher?
Just secureinfo.com.
Secureinfo.com. Yeah, the handle on Twitter is secureinfocorp, so I get these confused all the time. More for me to remember. We've talked about FISMA. We've talked about Congress. We talked about Tom Davis. We've all these big, big issues. Let's maybe notch it down to a little more specific here and talk about FedRAMP. FedRAMP's initiative just instigated here in the last few weeks. Maybe you can give us a thumbnail sketch of FISMA and how it impacts my federal listeners, please.
Sure.
FedRAMP.
FedRAMP, sure. FedRAMP, the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program, was launched last Wednesday, so just over a week ago. And it is a process by which you can have a single authorization for a cloud service provider solution that others across government can point to when it comes to their authorization. So
reduces duplication. So your agency doesn't have to vet.
Absolutely. Save money, reduce cycle time, and so on. Doesn't mean you have to use it, although the FedRAMP has now said that anybody buying cloud services needs to have an assessment done against that new standard. But You can still independently decide to do your own authorization if you so choose. It's a good initiative because it basically does provide for that economy of scale. It was an effort that was led by the GSA with strong involvement from the DHS and also the DOD. And the effort was to basically say in the cloud world, we need to make sure that we exercise further due diligence and care when deploying systems because they're being operated by third parties. That's the nature of the cloud beast. Now, you can, of course, have private clouds inside government, and then DHS has a private cloud. But this in particular was related to third-party commercial providers of cloud solutions, everything from infrastructure as a service to platform as a service to software as a service.
So the relationship with NIST is that they deeply understand the standards that are coming from NIST or the guidance that NIST is offering, and they can guarantee to agencies that their cloud solution will comply with NIST regulations? Is that what it's all about?
Yes, basically it's an assessment against the NIST framework, and I should have mentioned NIST was involved in this as well.
Yeah, that's the connection between you and NIST and FedRAMP.
Right. I just as an example, if you look at a moderate system, which is a designation as to the level of sensitivity, in the normal NIST guidance framework, there are 260 security controls you need to apply. In the FedRAMP world, in the cloud world, that goes to 313. So there are what are called control enhancements. The bar is raised for the cloud provider because cloud is, again, third party, and it's a multi-tenant environment in many cases, not always, but in many cases. So the bar is set higher. And NIST was involved in basically helping to select what control enhancements would be applied for those systems.
So if you're working for an agency and you're on a team that is being forced to make a transition to the cloud, one option is to consider a FedRAMP solution. That's just one of the options that you have. Is that right?
That's correct. And FedRAMP just became open for business last Wednesday, as I mentioned. And there are many cloud service providers that have applied for a FedRAMP certification. Nobody's actually got a FedRAMP certification today. We've actually been heavily involved over the past 2 to 3 years now, working with cloud providers on getting them to an ATO, an authority to operate pre-FedRAMP. So if you're, you know, going back to FISMA, you've got to have an authority to operate to light up a system on the network, on a government network that contains government data. And people were getting ATOs on cloud solutions before FedRAMP. USDA has 120,000 email users of the Microsoft Exchange solution and SharePoint solutions in the cloud. We worked heavily with Microsoft on that effort. We also have recently done work with Amazon Web Services, getting to, you know, working with them as part of an ATO process.
And that's really my challenge in understanding ATO. So Microsoft would be the ATO or Amazon would be the ATO?
In that case, there are two different offerings, two different customer sets. The ATO is a designation that an authorizing official in government gives to a system. They basically have said, in this case, it was the CIO of USDA for the Microsoft Exchange solution in the cloud, which, by the way, was a private cloud solution, but still run on Microsoft servers and Microsoft data centers. The AO, the authorizing official, was the CIO, basically said, I accept the fact that this system has gone through the proper diligence and care, and is that the risk associated with running my email in this environment is acceptable relative to the mission trade-offs, because there's risk in everything.
There's a company called CGI Federal, and they've recently gotten awarded a big contract in this area. And so what they can assure an agency is that they comply with these standards. Are they one of the ATOs as well, or where do they fit in this landscape?
A lot of the big integrators are involved in bringing the cloud solutions to market. I mentioned we've done work with Amazon Web Services. Their integrator, that kind of the face to the government, was Aptus in that case. So we actually, it was basically a three-party effort, Aptus being the contracting, the contractor basically working with the government. It was an Amazon cloud solution behind that, and we were involved in applying the security frameworks and helping both parties navigate the guidance.
I've had folks in the studio here who talk about COBOL. And, you know, I was at an event last month, and they talked about the number of older applications in enterprises in general in the federal government. And they're talking about 10, 15, 20-year-old large corporate applications. I would think that, you know, if you're charged with moving one of these applications to the cloud, I would think that security is got to be one of the first concerns, because when these applications were developed, security is just a layer and layer and layer on top of these old code. I mean, this has got to be a challenge for some of my listeners.
And actually, it's kind of funny. I think sometimes the older the system, maybe the more secure it is.
Oh, we never thought of that.
Because the bad guys are focused on the new state-of-the-art stuff. They want to get to my iOS platform or my Android platform. And I actually have heard a story, this is very funny, where an adversary had compromised a system, but in order to be able to effectively apply its zero-day attacks, the system wasn't patched to the level that was required to be able to exploit that system. So the adversary was patching the system without the end agency knowing it, and then once it was patched, it was able to apply the exploit.
It's almost breaking into your house and painting a couple of the rooms and leaving and coming back the
or
next night.
Or putting a new lock on the door before you try to break in.
Yeah, that would be it. That's interesting. Well, I think that's a challenge that I think enterprises have, and companies like ExxonMobil, if you have an older application moving to the cloud, is it going to be more vulnerable or less vulnerable? And I think that's what FedRAMP and some of the organizations like NIST are trying to accomplish. When you talked about Android, I saw a press release this morning where a safety company, security company called Sophos, S-O-P-H-O-S, they're starting to rank numbers of mobile attacks and giving them specific names for Androids. I mean, now we not only know the malware, we know them well, and we can list them in the top 10.
Right, and the platform, the mobile platform, is just another ripe platform to exploit. And again, we talked earlier about how naive users get something, they click on it, and then they become an affected entry point for an adversary.
And how much mobile focus is there on the new FISMA publication 800-53? Anything at all?
NIST certainly is well aware of the mobile, the importance of mobile and securing mobile platforms. And the way you need to look at mobile is it's just another compute platform, just like cloud is a compute platform, traditional compute platforms. The NIST framework actually kind of rides above that. It can be applied across different types of compute platforms. Now, there are specialized publications for certain platforms like mobile and the supervisory control, the SCADA systems I mentioned earlier. But the base publications are intended to work across compute platforms.
So it takes it at a different level than worrying about versions of Android operating systems or specific mobile devices that change every 6 months.
Yeah, the base guidance operates that way, like 853 or 837, which is the framework, the overall risk management framework. It operates at a level that cuts across compute platforms.
So from a company like yours, Secure Info, from their perspective, you work mostly with the system security and making sure that people who move to the clouds are compliant. I mean, I'm trying to connect your company with mobile devices. I don't know if that is even a connection there at all or not.
Sure. One of the services we provide, for example, is what we call penetration testing. And what you're doing with penetration testing is you're simulating an attack. It's called white hat hacking or ethical hacking, basically trying to find the vulnerability from an outside in perspective to determine where the holes are so that you can provide advice on how to fix and remediate those issues and mitigate the risks. So one of the things you can do in penetration testing is you can create an attack vector around the mobile platform. You can create phishing attacks that are spear phishing or general phishing attacks, and mobile certainly in the mix. One of the big talks in government right now is the BYOD, bring your own device issue. Everybody's walking around with a smartphone, or most people are walking around with smartphones these days, and they want to take them everywhere they go.
All kinds of security headaches there. Let's take a break. When we come back, talk more about security from 40,000 feet. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today's guest is Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President Secure Info, a Kratos company. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President, Secure Info, a Kratos company. If you're interested in security, you can go to the website, secureinfo.com. They offer classes. They offer a whole lot more than that. But I got to kind of dance on this lightly because you deal with a lot of people, the DOD and the intelligence community. And I don't want to get arrested as I'm walking out of the studio here, Christopher. So we'll touch on these light topics. But here's an important topic. Many of my listeners are scratching their head listening and saying, geez, this guy's got a degree in engineering. Is he really a card-carrying nerd? Give him the test, John. So I'm going to give you the test here. 10 questions. We're going to scientifically find out what nerd classification you are. The year you bought your first computer?
1987.
Seven? That's respectable.
The first computer I used, John, was a TRS-80.
Trash 80. We know those 80. Real well. And you probably had a used one in 87.
And actually, I used a deck writer before that, in truth, in high school. A deck writer, which is the
Digital Equipment Corporation deck. I remember it real well.
And no screen. It was a piece of paper that was scrolled through the device.
I know all those old-fashioned. 87, that's not bad. First cell phone, what year?
1988. It was a bag phone, and it cost me over $1,000.
And your kids aren't going to believe that. Don't bother. Even tell them that, because they're going to think you're on drugs.
The good thing about that phone, it was a full 3 watts versus the handhelds today are sub 1 watt. I think they're 0.7 watts. And I could be on an airplane at 30,000 feet on that phone. That was before the FAA had rules about phones because nobody had them.
Yeah. And you probably buy a second seat just for the phone. It was so big. you don't have a Twitter feed, so you lose points there. You don't have a blog, you lose points there. Yeah. Do you use any personal online backup?
I do. Back up all of my pictures onto two machines at home, two PCs. I have redundancy at my house. Mm-hmm. And then I also back it up to a hard drive, which I take off site and keep at a different location in case my house burns down, God forbid.
So belt and suspenders, not bad.
That's right.
What kind of smartphone do you have?
A Droid phone, but I'm seriously considering moving to Windows.
Okay. And number of apps on that Droid?
Probably about a dozen apps. I'm kind of a meat and potatoes apps guy, like the Wall Street Journal app, the sports app. Stocks, weather, travel.
You're going to have to bump that up to be a real nerd. And what kind of tablet device do you
have? I do have Angry Birds.
What kind of tablet device do you have?
We have Kindle and iPad in our
house. Not the Wii. It's you. What do you have?
I steal them both. My phone is a pretty big phone, so it's almost like a mini iPad.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not even giving credit for that one because the Wii, in my house, I know what the Wii is.
My kids.
We are going to go shopping for shoes, and we are going to go on vacation. Okay. Social networking sites you participate in?
LinkedIn and Facebook, but mainly Facebook to watch my kids. So they have to friend me on Facebook so I can kind of monitor their behavior.
Well, good luck with that. And your last book read was electronic or paper?
It was paper.
Paper.
I attended a management seminar at Wharton a few weeks ago and met a professor, Yuseem, and he wrote a very good book. I'd highly recommend it, called The Leader's Checklist. And
up
it's
in
15
Philadelphia.
Principles up in Philadelphia. Yeah. And it's 15 principles about good leadership.
Yeah, I think that's great. I like to read books about the ancient Romans. They had great leadership principles, as well as a fellow named Julius Caesar, who I think
right.
he had that down.
Well, he actually, in his book, talks about the Civil War and the famous stand on Little Round Top.
Yes, we know about that, but there are a lot of lessons to be learned from those folks. Let's move from ancient Rome to current Washington, D.C. You've testified up on Capitol Hill, quite the fancy lad, by the way, doing that. So you have a pretty good idea of what's going on here. I have a certified crystal ball here, and I want you to give me your exact predictions for the Super Bowl. No, I want your exact predictions for information security trends in the next 5 to 7 years, where you see this heading, where, you know, something's going to happen in the fall here. We're going to get a new president, or something's going to change. I don't know what. Maybe it'll be the same president. I don't know. That's going to affect the intelligence community here much. Where do you see it all heading? Is it all going to be mobile? Is a desktop computer? Your kid's not even going to believe desktop computers existed, or what's going on here?
First of all, in terms of sports, I'm a Michigan grad, so I'm going to
predict Michigan.
On the Big Ten and Michigan specifically doing well this year in football. Our key quarterback's coming back, Denard Robinson. You know, unfortunately, I think, you know, if you look 5 to 10 years out, there will be a, you know, Congressman Davis calls it a digital Pearl Harbor. There will be a very bad thing that happens in the cybersecurity world. And that will be a wake-up call to the legislatures and the general population. I unfortunately don't think we're in a place where we can say that we were able to mitigate that risk. And I think something bad like that will happen. Hopefully we're in a position at that time where we can respond quickly and mitigate the issue and move forward.
So you think it's going to be just information stolen? Is there going to be the electrical system go down? I mean,
I think it'll have a physical, kinetic effect. It won't just, I mean, today information's being stolen, money's being stolen, identities are being stolen. And that's kind of the price of doing business today in cyberspace. That's happening every day. I mean, what I'm talking about is something that will have a physical effect. Lights going out, a transportation system impact, something that we will clearly will have a physical manifestation that we all can understand and appreciate when it happens.
So when it comes to risk management, they say a recession is when your neighbor loses his job and a depression is when you lose your job.
And in
risk management, if my Social Security number gets stolen, well, it's no big thing. But all of a sudden, if the lights go on in my house for a week, that's the risk. Bang, people are going to understand it and want to fund it then.
Absolutely, and there have been studies done about how fast people start dying when the power goes out.
Wow.
If you think about our lives and what we depend on for kind of everyday life and just power. Without power, you know, hospitals have generators, but those generators can go only so long, and the civil structure starts to break down.
I was on a telephone conversation with someone in Gaithersburg, and I said I thought the line dropped out, and I said, "Are you still there?" He said, "Yeah, just me and the Chinese government." And I can joke about it because I'm not working for the federal government. But, I mean, I think China has stolen an astonishing amount of information from the United States without us even knowing some of it. I mean, and I think we can joke about it and laugh about it. And that, you know, it's not going to affect people in Cleveland or in Tennessee or in Florida. But, you know, if Aunt Matilda dies because she doesn't have electricity, bang, that's a punch to the head. Then they're going to realize something bad's happened.
Right. Absolutely. And again, unfortunately, I just think it's a matter of time. If you go back to 2007, Estonia was attacked, presumably by the Russians. Nobody knows for sure because anonymity is one of the challenges in the internet. Attribution is a challenge. And in 2007, there was an attempt to bring down the internet infrastructure of Estonia, which is heavily dependent on that infrastructure. And they had to disconnect the country from the net. They literally shut down the connection to the internet. Now, Estonia could do that. Because they had a fairly few number of points where they connected to the broader internet. We couldn't do that in the United States.
Do you view this possible threat as being politically motivated or motivated by people, let's say, in Russia who are mobsters looking for money? What kind of motivation?
Again, today there's hacktivism, which happens day in and day out. People that are doing things just to embarrass others. That will continue, I think. Those are fairly benign, though, with respect to the digital Pearl Harbor scenario. I think that will continue. Hacktivism will continue. And I can't speak to what specific motives they might have, but there's certainly an interest in doing things that embarrass others. financial motives are clearly happening and have happened for years and will continue to happen, I believe. And that gets into identity theft and you know, taking money out of bank accounts and so on, or having money wired to remote places. This, what I'm talking about, is a whole new world, though, where you're attempting to impact our way of life in a more fundamental way. And the motive for that could be, I think terrorism's a motive that would drive certain organizations to do that. I don't know if a formal state actor would be involved in that, unless things got to a point around the world where there was another potential war that was developing, you know, with the things that happened in the Middle East and in North Korea. That could lead to something happening. It's hard to say what will drive it, but unfortunately, I think something will happen. The scale of which I can't predict, but something that will happen that will impact our physical.
And I think what's shocking is that it may be in place now and it's undetected and may be weaponized in 2 or 3 years. I mean, because we don't know what's out there now. Look at Flame. They talk about a few hundred machines or a few thousand machines, but how many machines are compromised that aren't aware of it at all?
Right. I mean, that's the big threat, which is what's out there sitting ready to be activated from a remote site. You know, zero-day attacks are very common. The belief is that adversaries have a catalog of zero-day attacks that they just pull off the shelf when they want to use them. But how many of those things have been put in place that are yet to be activated? It's hard to know.
Yeah, makes for good science fiction, but bad for reality. We're going to have to end our conversation here about security from 40,000 feet. I'd like to thank my guest, Christopher Fountain, Senior Vice President of Secure Info. It is a Kratos company. Thank you very much, Christopher.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of the Armature Corporation, providing consulting, application development, and business productivity solutions on the Microsoft platform. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk, Tuesday mornings at 11, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.